This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This past December, a surprising study came out in the journal Science. The study showed that people could change the mind of voters on big issues like gay marriage and abortion. And all they needed was a short 20-minute chat face-to-face with those people. The results sounded almost too good to be true. This week, though, it obviously was. That paper was retracted by one of the authors. The data may have been completely made up. We ran the story on Science Friday. We believed it also. And joining me to talk about that finding, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Rachel Feltman. She runs the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. She's here in our New York studios. Good to see you back, Rachel.
Nice. Thanks for having me.
That retracted study in Science received a lot of attention. Like I say, we ran that story also.
Yeah, it was covered pretty much everywhere, I think. And everyone thought that it seemed miraculous. And the reason is that most studies have found the opposite to be true. When people have these strong convictions, if you present evidence as to why they shouldn't have those convictions, they actually kind of double down and feel even more strongly that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. So it seemed too good to be true that if someone came to you and explained why, as a gay person, they wanted you to support same-sex marriage, you should.
They thought that if you actually met people, right,
that was the key.
Yeah, that was
that
the key.
You needed
not
to
a third
humanize
party.
The yeah. issue. And unfortunately, the prominent professor who was one of the names on the study, Green, he has now asked for the study to be retracted. And his co-author, who's the one who handled all of the raw data, has asked for, he said that he stands by it, yeah, and that in a week he'll bring out definitive evidence. But the reason it seems that Green has been so transparent about asking for it to be retracted is that this supposedly was this huge scale study and huge scale data collection. So you would think that LaCour, the author who collected the data, would have some evidence ready to go to say, no, 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 this really happened. There should be a huge paper mm-hmm. trail. And he's not forthcoming with any of that.
So are they accusing him of just making up the stuff?
Well, it's really unclear what happened because he won't comment yet. And it may have been kind of a slippery slope that ended with complete fabrication, yeah, but it's very unclear. And it seems what happened is that a couple of grad students tried to reproduce the study because they found the results so impressive. And any important study has to be reproduced. But unfortunately, once they got into the process of reproducing it, they just found irregularity after irregularity, which they then brought mm-hmm. to Green's attention. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about another story, the stone tool that might predate, the oldest stone tool ever
yes.
found?
So this is a stone tool found in Kenya that's 3.3 million years old, which is almost a million years older than the oldest one found previously. And it's very simple, but the reason it's exciting is that this predates our genus, Homo, you know, the famous handyman Homo habilis, who conventionally we thought was the first species to use tools. And so it could be that an entirely different genus was actually the first tool user. And it's cool because the hand actions used to create the markings on the tool are more primitive. They're rudimentary. Mm. They're more like what you see an ape doing, trying to break a nut open. But the intention is clearly to make a tool. So it's a very neat kind of missing link between not knowing how to make tools at all and making what Homo habilis made.
How old is the tool?
3.3 million years.
Oh, isn't that where Lucy is? Lucy's
yeah,
at that time?
It would have been a contemporary of Lucy. And there's a contender because there's a species that was found very close to the tool that has been named as a new species and genus. It's different from anything we've found before. And it's possible that was a precursor to Homo.
Exciting. Let's talk about 3D printing. Something new with 3D printing?
Sure, yeah. So 3D printing skin, actually.
Skin?
Yes. L'Oreal, the cosmetics company, has announced that they're partnering with a a medical 3D printing company to 3D print cell by cell, layer by layer, human skin, which sounds very creepy, but it's actually less creepy than what they do now. To avoid animal testing, they actually take scraps donated from plastic surgery and grow them into mats of human skin. And in a year, it takes 60 scientists a year to make a cowhide worth of human skin. That's their analogy, not mine. Again,
it's
very creepy.
Yeah.
So the idea is that they'll be able to 3D print on demand all different types of skin for testing.
Well, wait a minute. You mean you load up a 3D printer with skin cells?
I mean, basically.
And you just print it out and you get tissue, like it becomes skin, a size, name, shape that you could draw a diagram in it of a name if you want?
Yeah, the same way people are trying to bioprint organs.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of load up the right stem cells and do it layer by layer.
Wow. Let's talk about another story, the fossil in Washington State.
Yeah. Washington State was the 37th state to find their first dinosaur fossil. And the researchers involved actually think it may be the last state to find its first dinosaur fossil. Washington was kind of the last holdout where we could expect to find a dinosaur and hadn't found one yet. And it was this big bone that once they dug it out of the rock, they found signs that it was a land animal. And because of the size, that meant there was a pretty good chance it was some kind of dinosaur. Then they found out the bone was hollow, which is a trademark of birds that came from dinosaurs. And then they went around trying to compare it to known dinosaur bones from the same era. And sure enough, they found a match. So
what kind? Was it a meat eater? Or what?
Well, so they know it was a theropod, which is the same group that T-Rex is in. But it's hard to tell anything else.
Well, we'll wait for the next bones. You can't just have one dinosaur anywhere. Finally, you got a quirky panda story. This is amazing.
Yeah, so it turns out that pandas actually have very weird gut bacteria. Their gut bacteria seems to be left over from back when they were carnivores, even though for 2 million years they've been eating nothing but bamboo. So giant pandas are actually only able to digest something like 17% of the 30 pounds of bamboo they eat every day.
No kidding.
Yeah, and their the biome in their gut has just not changed at all. And they're able to do this because they've adapted to just sit around eating tons of food and pooping most of it undigested. And they do just fine that way.
Well, they would have to eat a lot of food because they're not digesting most of it.
Yeah, they're eating
right?
Like four times as much food as they would if they had the proper bacteria in
their gut. Give them, you know, a hamburger and see if they would eat it? I mean, they have the gut bacteria for that, right?
That's a good question.
All right, I'm not going to tell the National Zoo or whatever, anybody in China what to do. Thank you, Rachel, for taking time. Those are fascinating stories. Rachel Feltman, she runs a Speaking of Science blog in Washington Post. Thanks, Rachel. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Earlier this week, a study came out in the journal Nature Chemical Biology that talked about the possibility for engineering yeast, yes, the same stuff that makes bread rise and helps brew beer, engineering yeast to be able to turn sugar into opiate drugs, such as morphine. It hasn't been done yet, but researchers have mapped out a good deal of the pathway that would need to be created. And here to play Good Thing, Bad Thing with me is Megan Palmer. She used to be a bioengineer herself, and now she's a research fellow studying policy and biosafety at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Ready to play Good Thing, Bad Thing?
I sure am.
All right. Give us the good thing about this.
Well, the good news is that researchers are getting better at building biology-based platforms to produce a whole wide variety of compounds that are difficult, inefficient, and sometimes just impossible to create through other means. So researchers are improving these tools to make biosynthetic pathways, combining enzymes that are able to do chemical transformations and convert low-value compounds into high-value compounds. So in this case, we're using yeast, and we can use these platforms to produce not just drugs, but also other things like materials or fuels or scents.
Mm-hmm. Why,
so the researchers, go ahead.
Now I'm just going to ask, why is this an advantage over the way we do things now?
So there are many different ways that we gain access to the drugs that the researchers showed this week. Mostly they're agricultural-based productions, and sometimes these can be unreliable, sourced from many other places. And some of the types of drugs that we want access to that are derivatives of these, we can more easily modify them in these yeast-based platforms. And so some of these are things like anti-cancer agents and also potentially cheaper or more efficient drugs to replace current opiates that might be less prone to abuse.
All right, so
but overall, the really good news is that we haven't gone through this entire pathway yet, and researchers are engaging on the topic of how to produce them safely and efficiently up front.
And that's good that they're engaging it, because that is part of the bad thing.
Yes, so there is some bad news here. The great news is we have a chance to get ahead of this right now. But one significant concern is that if we put the full pathway to go from glucose to this intermediate and then all the way to things like morphine, then this could actually feed into illicit markets and bolster new illicit markets. So the worry this week that was prominently discussed was around producing heroin. So because yeast is a platform to allow decentralized production, it means that if this were to be made robust and integrated, it could leak out, and it could allow sort of this homebrew option for producing narcotics that are a significant problem.
How easy is that, though, to do that?
Is this right now, there's a lot of expert knowledge really required to both integrate the pathway and also to make it come to scale and produce significant amounts of the compound. And so some estimates are, you know, several years and a lot of expert knowledge, including a PhD in bioengineering. But if the full pathway were to be integrated, that would be a concern. So the good news is we have choices both in the engineering design and in the regulation.
Mm-hmm. And so we'll just keep an eye on this, see how this...
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great things happening, but also a lot of difficult policy concerns.
You know, why does that sound familiar? Yeah. Thank you, Megan. Dr. Megan Palmer, Research Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University.